Lecture 18, Trade Policy.
In these last few lectures, we want to shift the focus just a little bit and start looking at the international sector. In this lecture, we'll focus on trade policy, the next one we'll focus on exchange rates, and then in the final lecture, we'll take a global view of the whole economy. We've talked about trade policy a little bit already. For example, we had a lecture in particular on exports and imports and on what economists mean by the balance of trade. But we really haven't gotten into what most people think of the real trade issues, the issues of free trade and fair trade and protectionism and how much trade we should be having in the U.S. economy. To a large extent, this is all a battle of labels, of course. Just as in the dispute over abortion, we have a pro-life side and a pro-choice side, where each side latches on to a nice-sounding label. In trade, we have the free traders and the fair traders, and each side latches on to a nice-sounding label there. I'll admit up front my biases here. My bias is that most of the people who talk about fair trade actually don't believe in free trade. An example of this would be Pat Buchanan, who I believe will be probably still running for Republican nomination for president whenever these lectures are given. But Buchanan has proposed that we have a tax on imports, and that tax would be designed to make sure that people in other countries have to pay their workers just as much as we pay workers in the United States. So, for example, U.S. minimum wage laws and all wage levels would have to apply to Mexico and Indonesia and countries in Africa and around the world. Now, Buchanan refers to that as fair trade. It may be fair, it may not be fair. I don't really want to get into the issue of fairness in that way. But there's no way in the world that it's free trade to talk about something like that, dictating wage levels to other countries. And most of the time, when you get into talking about fair trade, what you almost immediately find is that people say, well, I believe in free trade, but only if it's fair, and fair involves the following sets of conditions. By the time you've put in those conditions in place, we're not talking free anymore. When I hear fair trade, I'm typically suspicious, and I'm typically right to be suspicious. In thinking about trade, let's start off by talking about where gains from trade come from. Why might international trade be beneficial to all parties? The beginning idea of how we might have beneficial things happening for both sides is known to economists as absolute advantage. And a simple example of absolute advantage would be to take two countries, each of which is best or most efficient in producing a particular good. A simple example might be the United States producing farm products and Saudi Arabia producing oil. Now, in the United States, we have lots and lots of fertile land. We have wonderful conditions for growing something like wheat or corn. In Saudi Arabia, they have a lot of sand, not usually thought of as your best growing material. On the flip side of things, in the United States, we now need to dig pretty deep for our oil. We need to go up to Alaska. We have to build long pipelines. There's a lot of difficulties in getting oil. In Saudi Arabia, it's almost like you stick a shovel in the ground and it bubbles up out of the ground. It's a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's a whole lot cheaper to get oil in Saudi Arabia than it is to get it here. So, this offers a possibility for mutual gain. We'll ship farm products over to Saudi Arabia. They'll ship oil over here. Both sides can be better off because they can get what they need at a lower cost. That fundamentally is the idea of absolute advantage. Now, of course, there are a lot of concerns one can raise here. What if we become dependent on oil? Let me put all those concerns off for now and just say there's at least a possibility of gain, and we'll come back to the worries later on. But what if we have a situation where one country is perhaps more efficient at producing both items or many items? For example, if you look at the United States and Mexico, it looks like over a wide, wide range of products, the U.S. is going to be more efficient. We have more efficient workers. We have more capital. Productivity is just higher in the United States. It is a remarkable result of economics, a result that dates back to David Ricardo early in the 19th century, that even if you have a situation where one country is more efficient at the production of all goods, has an absolute advantage in the production of all goods, it can still make sense for those two countries to trade with each other, and both countries can benefit from that trade. Now, to try and give you a feeling for why this can be true, this theory of comparative advantage, as it's called among economists, let me give you an example which should maybe clarify the underlying principle. I've never had a true full-time secretary who worked for me, but I've seen people who had secretaries, and based on that idea, imagine this possibility. You have a secretary. Let's say there's a lot of things that need to be typed. And let's also say that, for the sake of argument, you are not only a better manager than your secretary, but you are also a faster typist. This is not hypothetical. There are a lot of managers who could be very good typists. The question is, if you are more efficient at being a manager and more efficient at being a typist, should you type all the stuff yourself? Or should you hand it off to the secretary? Well, if you answer, I would type everything myself, big buzzer goes off, that's a wrong answer. Of course, if you've got the secretary there, you let the secretary type the stuff even if the secretary is slow. And the reason is because having the secretary type the stuff frees up time for you to do other things. It frees up time for you to focus on what you're doing best. What are you going to do otherwise? Just have the secretary waste time in the office and not accomplish anything? You might as well give them something to do, because it will save time for you. Let me ask you a similar question. Should the basketball player Michael Jordan mow his own lawn? I would guess, given that this man is a world-class athlete, that he can mow his lawn much more quickly than anyone he can hire. When it comes to lawn mowing, he has to be a very, very efficient person. But of course he shouldn't mow his own lawn. That would be silly. It makes sense for him to hire someone else, let that other person focus on the lawn, and free up time for him to do things like playing basketball or playing golf or doing celebrity endorsements, where he really has a great advantage. The theory of comparative advantage is that it makes sense for you to focus on what you do best and where your advantage is greatest. If you don't have something where you do it best, then it makes sense for you to focus on where you are least bad, or to think about it a little differently, where your disadvantage is smallest. And whenever you think about dividing up work among a group of people, this general principle will hold. I think sometimes about going camping with my family. My father was an Eagle Scout growing up, and when we go camping, he can do everything best. There's no question. Dad is best at setting up the tent. He's best at setting up the campfire site. He's best at getting wood. He's best at starting the fire. Dad's just most efficient at everything. Well, does it make sense then for us all just to make Dad do all the work? Well, no, actually. If Dad had to do all the work, a lot of it probably wouldn't actually get done, or it wouldn't get done very well. Instead, it makes sense for Dad to focus on the things where his advantage is greatest, and for the rest of us to focus on things like, say, gathering firewood, where maybe we're not the most efficient, but where our disadvantage is least. And those things where we are least bad, where our advantage is, or our disadvantage is least, are referred to as our area of comparative advantage. It's not absolute advantage. Doesn't mean we're best at it or most efficient at it. It just means that that's the area where we're least bad. You'll occasionally hear someone say or write something like, trade won't work because there are some countries out there that have no area of comparative advantage. If you hear someone say something like that, you know they're economically illiterate. There may be countries out there that don't have any absolute advantage. They don't have any area where they're best, but everyone has an area where they're least bad. Almost by definition, everyone has an area where they're least bad. In a way, it's kind of uplifting if you think about it. We're always so focused on how do I be the best at something. Well, this theory of economics says you don't have to be the best. You just have to seek out the area where you're least bad and focus in on that. It's kind of uplifting in its own odd kind of way. So when we think about trade between countries, what we really want to think about is not everyone having an absolute advantage, but we want to think about countries focusing in on the areas where they have a comparative advantage, where either they're best off or where they're least bad. And those sorts of exchanges, like a manager working with a secretary, like Michael Jordan mowing his lawn, like going camping with some expert where you want to try and help out as best you can, all of those things work as to how the United States, a very efficient and productive country, can still trade and gain from trade by trading with folks who are less efficient or less productive. Of course, comparative advantage and absolute advantage will shift over time. There'll be examples where a country for some time may make basic products like cotton, then eventually they may start spinning cotton into cloth, they may start weaving and cutting cloth, they may work toward other kinds of machinery, and gradually countries do develop their economies. So nothing about this process has to be static. But even as countries develop and grow, the process of trade can be very helpful. Because after all, As you trade, you learn from those you trade with. You get new ideas about technology, new ideas about management, new ideas about products. And as you get those sorts of ideas and change, trade will help drive forward the process of evolution and technology, which you want to have if your economy is going to grow over time. All of what I've said up to this point emphasizes that there are possibly gains from trade. That's a big point to emphasize because so many people talk as if trade is always I win, you lose. We traded with Japan, Japan won, we lost. And what I'm trying to emphasize here is that there are gains for both sides. When we think about trade, our starting point needs to be that both sides can be better off at the end. Now, of course, saying both sides can possibly be better off is different from saying that both sides are necessarily better off. There are possibilities of losses from trade, at least for certain groups as well. And because there are possibilities of losses, people think about how we might restrict trade. Let me talk first about the mechanics of how trade might be restricted. There are a variety of tools for thinking about restricting trade. For example, one can have a quota on imports, and a quota would just say, this is how many you can send into the country, no more. End of story. You can have a tariff on imports. A tariff is just a tax on imports, and so you would say, sure, you can import stuff into the country, but as you import it into the country, we're going to put a tax on it, and that's, of course, going to make it a little harder to sell. There are things called voluntary export restraints. And when you hear an economist say voluntary export restraints, you'll almost always hear them go, voluntary, snicker, snicker, export restraints. Because typically export restraints aren't voluntary. What usually happens is the United States may be negotiating with some country. This happened, for example, with Japan in the 1980s. And we say to Japan, sure would like it if you would limit those cars you're sending over here. Sure would like it a lot. Really a lot. Really a lot. And at some point, Japan says, we're setting up some voluntary restraints on our exports. Now, of course, the voluntary happened with this sort of image of a big stick just about to strike. Typically, countries don't voluntarily restrict their exports unless they're threatened in some way. But if it's not an official threat, we still refer to it as voluntary. There are also things called non-tariff barriers. Non-tariff barriers just refer to all the things a country can do to shut out imports that don't explicitly involve prices or quantities, but involve some sort of bureaucracy. For example, there was a proposal, I believe, in Sweden a few years ago that every car imported into Sweden would have to have windshield wipers on the headlights. Now, it turned out that cars being made in Sweden by Volvo already had the windshield wipers on the headlights, so it was no problem for them. But other cars coming into the country would have needed special additions. Well, that's sort of a bureaucratic restriction. It may be necessary, it may not be, but it serves to discourage imports from coming in. The global masters at non-tariff barriers are clearly the French. The French are just the best at saying, oh, we'll import all you want. However, it all needs to go through one small town in inland France where there will be one person to process the forms. You can send all you want there, and, you know, it's no problem. It just may take a while, like a year, before stuff actually gets out of the warehouse and can be sold in the rest of the economy. So, in all of these ways, when we're restricting imports, they all have a common effect. The common effect is that they're reducing the supply of imports coming into the country. And by reducing the supply of imports coming into the country, what will happen is the price will go up, and domestic producers will be able to sell at a higher price than they otherwise would. Now, sometimes people say, well, that's not right. You know, if we protect, we won't have higher prices. But when you think about it, the whole purpose of protection, the whole purpose of shutting out the products has to be higher prices. After all, if the domestic companies couldn't sell at a higher price, they wouldn't benefit from this happening. If we're going to protect them or benefit domestic companies for whatever reason, then we're going to need to do that by shutting out supply and letting our domestic companies earn higher profits than they would before. Now, when you think about it in that light, I think protectionism takes on a little bit of a different tone. When you think about protectionism from an economic point of view, what it really is a way of government setting the rules, in this case the rules of trade, but setting the rules in such a way that domestic companies can earn higher profits. And the reason they can earn higher profits is they can charge consumers more. To put it a little bit differently, it's just a way of providing an indirect subsidy to industry. It's an indirect subsidy where consumers pay more, domestic businesses get more. And that's all protectionism is. We can dress up the reasons and the causes however we like, but that's fundamentally what's going on under the skin, and not that far under the skin, to tell the truth. Okay, that said, let's now think about the arguments for protectionism. What are the arguments for restricting imports from other countries or cutting back on them? Well, the first argument, the argument you hear most commonly, is that imports cost jobs. Sort of say, well, we have to buy U.S., we have to buy U.S. products, because if we buy imports, we're costing jobs in the U.S. Now, this argument, if you think about it just a little bit, leads some odd places, and odd places that make one suspicious of the argument. Let me try and give you sort of a lead-in to why one might be suspicious of that line of thought. Say, for example, that in the U.S. economy in the late 1990s, we were simply shut out all imports. Just prohibit them. Just cut them out altogether. Well, that imports are now about 11-12% of gross domestic product. So all of a sudden, that 11-12% of gross domestic product that we were importing wasn't there. Do we really believe, if that happened, that unemployment would drop from where it is now, around 5%, a little lower, and go all the way down to zero? Do we really believe that if there just weren't imports, we would have zero unemployment? After all, what about frictional unemployment? What about structural unemployment? What about cyclical unemployment? There's no reason to think that getting rid of imports will get rid of frictional unemployment or get rid of structural unemployment. There's not even any particular reason to think it'll get rid of cyclical unemployment. After all, why would you automatically have more demand in your economy because you got rid of imports? So when you start thinking about what's the connection here, how are we getting from fewer imports to more jobs, it's less obvious than one might at first think. What typically happens, of course, is that if imports go down, then foreigners are earning fewer dollars in this country. And if they have fewer dollars in the U.S., then they're going to buy fewer U.S. products. They'll buy fewer exports. And the result, or of course, they may not invest the money back in the U.S. If they don't invest the money back in the U.S., we'll have less investment in this country as well. So what tends to happen is, when we shut out imports, what we're really doing is tending to hurt the export part of the economy. Sure, when you shut out imports, you get more jobs in the industries that are protected. If we said we're not going to import any cars, then there would be more jobs in Detroit for car makers. But while we would be helping that one particular industry, we would be causing a problem for a lot of other industries, because they would no longer be able to sell their products abroad. The buying power abroad wouldn't be as great as it was before. Again, when we think about protectionism, we think about shutting out imports, it's really just a way of providing a subsidy to one particular industry. And that subsidy helps that industry, no question about it. It will certainly help the industry that's being protected, but as with so many subsidies, other people pay for it, and other industries are likely to be hurt. A second argument for protectionism is that it leads to lower wages. The argument here typically is that if you have to compete with, say, workers in Mexico, then we're going to end up paying Mexican wage levels. After all, if they're being paid 20 cents an hour or something like that, then U.S. employers are going to say, well, we're going to pay 20 cents an hour as well. Again, if you think about this argument for a moment, you have to sort of say to yourself, okay, if this is true, that trade will push wages down to third world levels, why hasn't it already happened? We've been trading with these countries for decades now. Why hasn't it already happened? Apparently there's something which over the last few decades has kept U.S. wages at a level much higher than Mexico's wages. And that reason, if you think back to our discussion of labor markets, is labor market productivity. Remember that wages are ultimately determined by what people produce. They're determined by productivity. The reason wages in the U.S. are higher than wages in Mexico is that, on average, productivity in the United States is a whole lot higher than productivity in Mexico. We have better educated workers, we have more physical capital, and they're working with better technology. This sort of worry that somehow someone in a third world country with a fifth grade education and a 20-year-old machine is going to outproduce someone on an assembly line in Detroit is just crazy. I mean, there's no way they can do that. And as long as workers in the United States produce more, they will continue to be paid more. Now, there is some reason to believe that for very low-skilled workers in the U.S. economy, their jobs are the ones which perhaps are most at risk from low-skilled workers abroad. They're bringing in imports from abroad does provide some competition for those low-skilled workers. So if you were a low-skilled textile worker in the United States, and there's a low-skilled textile worker in Mexico, that's a lot closer to being a real competition where it may affect the wages of that person. And so overall, what you expect to see because of trade is that workers in low-skilled industries maybe do a little bit worse, but workers in high-skilled industries definitely do better, because they are now able to use their productivity and sell their products all around the world. To the extent that trade raises the overall level of productivity in an economy by letting us each focus on our area of comparative advantage, the overall level of productivity being higher should mean that wages are higher for the economy as well. And if wages are overall higher, on average, that's probably a good thing for the economy, even though we may want to then say, well, wages are higher, but there's some inequality, and we need to redistribute from rich to poor. A third argument for having protectionism is sometimes called the infant industry argument. The infant industry argument goes like this. Our country is small and poor. We're just starting off on some particular kind of industry. We aren't ready to compete yet. Our industry is just a little baby. If we send our company out into the world to compete against those big companies from Europe, the US, Japan, we're going to get crushed. So we need to protect that company for a while until it grows up. And then when it grows up and it's strong and healthy, we'll turn it loose on the world, and then it will be able to compete well. The difficulty with this argument is that in practice, those little baby infant industries have a tendency not to grow up. And they have a tendency not to grow up precisely because they're being sheltered. And without the force of competition, they're not being pressured to grow up. One of the outstanding global examples here of an infant industry policy that didn't work very well was Brazil deciding in the early 1970s or the mid-1970s that it wanted to be a big computer manufacturer. And so they said, we're going to protect our infant industry, computer industry, until it grows up. Well, they protected their industry, they protected it, and by about 1990, I would say the Brazil industry was perfectly capable of making a computer which was about as good as what was available in the rest of the world in 1980. In other words, we're about 10 years behind. In the world of computers, 10 years is forever. At that point, they'd spent more than 15 years saying to all the companies in Brazil, no, you can't use up-to-date computers. You can't use them for banking. You can't use them for business. You can't use them for anything. You have to use these old, well, they were new, but they were an old-style Brazilian computers. You have to use out-of-date technology. So they were penalizing the entire economy by not allowing computer technology to spread for the sake of trying to subsidize this one particular industry. And, of course, the computer industry in Brazil was feeling really good. They're making profits. They're hiring people. But they're only doing it because they're being protected from global competition. Brazil probably would have been much better off competing and trying to get other companies to come down there and help them be at the cutting edge. An example in the United States that sometimes comes up in the last few years is the example of screens for laptop computers. There was a lot of argument about whether the screens for laptop computers should be protected in the United States until our screen industry could get up and running. And there's a lot of concern that these flat screens might not only be used for computers, but they might be the televisions of the future, that sort of modernistic television that you could just hang on the wall like a painting, and it would have a beautiful picture for you. So there's a worry, this is a big product, we need to protect it now, but think about it for a moment. When we start shutting out all the screens from Japan, what tends to happen is that our computer makers have to buy more expensive screens. That makes all our computers in the U.S. at a disadvantage. And people have to pay more and more for these screens, so they're less likely to use them. As a result, the people who are producing the screens can't really get their production up and running. The price is too high. And so when you think about protecting an infant industry, you really have to say to yourself, am I going to be ruthless about it 3 years from now? If this industry isn't growing up, am I going to just cut the subsidy? And some countries, South Korea is really one example, have managed to do that, where they said, we'll help the company for a short time, and then we're cutting it off, and you got to go on your own. Most countries really haven't been able to do that. Yet another argument for why we should shut out imports is the environment. The argument here is that in the United States, we have lots of laws for a clean environment. lots of laws about protecting the environment. And those laws involve costs as we try and look after those negative externalities. So the argument U.S. industry sometimes makes then is, we have to have all these high costs for environmental things. We can't compete with some company which is based in Latin America or in Africa and which doesn't face these same laws. The ultimate problem here, the ultimate question, I guess, is how do we make the world cleaner? If we're a strong environmentalist, how do I meet the goal of having a strong environment? Ultimately, I would say that what makes the world cleaner is making the world wealthier. Because, as we found in the United States the last few decades, a wealthy world is a world with resources to spend on a clean environment. If you cut off other countries and you say, we won't trade with you unless you apply first world pollution standards, without trade you have no leverage with them. And without trade they have no resources to fix things up. It was really interesting to me that at the time the North American Free Trade Agreement between the U.S. and Mexico was being debated, there were a number of environmental groups, not all of them, but a surprising number, like the Environmental Defense Fund, the National Wildlife Federation, the Audubon Society, all of which supported NAFTA, supported the trade with Mexico. And the reason was, they said, if we trade with Mexico, Mexico will have both the wealth and the incentive to enforce environmental laws. Whereas if we try and cut Mexico off, we know that a very poor country will have terrible environmental problems in short order. So, by all means, I would say, it's important to pursue environmental goals. I think that a lot of the time, however, when environmental goals are raised in the context of foreign trade, really, they're an excuse to try and shut out trade for other reasons. They're an excuse to try and get a subsidy for a certain kind of industry. And the evidence that we should try and pursue environmental goals by shutting off trade is, to me, just not very strong. In general, I would say, there are much better ways to pursue environmental goals than trying to cut off trade. Next argument for protectionism, and you may notice these arguments just multiply and multiply and multiply, is an argument which involves what's called predatory pricing or dumping. The argument about predatory pricing or dumping works like this. Imagine that some foreign company, first of all, comes into this country and sells imports at below cost. Really below cost, below reason, below good sense. And as they sell below cost, they drive out all the U.S. producers. They drive them into bankruptcy. Then, when all the U.S. producers have been driven into bankruptcy, and now the foreign producer is a monopolist. And as a monopolist, as we talked about before, they can raise their price and make really high profits. And by making really high profits, then they can earn back all their losses and make large profits into the future. Clearly, this would be somehow an unfair scenario. So if there was some company that was dumping, selling below cost, doing predatory pricing, we would have to worry about whether they were going to carry out this scenario and become a monopolist in the future. But while this scenario works in theory, it really doesn't seem to work in practice very well. There are lots and lots of examples, to be sure, of where foreign producers come in and undersell the competition, but the problem here is underselling is not dumping. Underselling is not predatory pricing. Underselling is just offering good, tough competition. There certainly are examples of U.S. companies that have been driven out of business by foreign producers. But again, that's just good, tough competition. That doesn't mean anything grossly unfair happened. Moreover, there are no examples, at least none I'm aware of, where the second step kicked in. That is, where the U.S. producer was driven out of the market, and then the foreign monopolist managed to raise prices and keep them high. But without that second step, raising prices and keeping them high, it's not clear why this is such a bad thing. All it would mean is that someone came in and offered really good, tough competition. So this idea of predatory pricing, while it's a scenario you can talk about, I believe there are literally zero cases where someone has been able to come in and sustain a monopoly at high prices. I mean, at worst, what would happen is, you drive out all the U.S. producers, you jack up prices, but then when you jack up prices, a whole bunch of new companies start up and start competing with you again. And if you have to worry about new companies coming back and competing with you again, it would make no sense to even try such a strategy. Some people argue that we should shut out imports because of national security. And often the concerns here are things like we shouldn't be dependent on other countries for oil or for minerals or for certain kinds of technology. This is an argument which has a lot of surface appeal, but again, if you look half a step down, I think it loses a lot of its appeal. Let's say for the sake of argument that it's tremendously important that the U.S. has large domestic reserves of oil, because if we were cut off, we would really need that oil. Fair enough. That's a good national security argument. Does that mean that we should stop importing oil now? I would think just the opposite would be true. If oil is tremendously important and we really want to have oil in the United States, surely we should import as much as possible from abroad while the importing is good. And the same with any other mineral that's important. Let's get them here. Let's not use up our U.S. resources. If oil is tremendously important, why should we be drilling American oil now? Why shouldn't we be saving up against the possibility of a national security problem later? It seems to me true with technology. If foreign technology is tremendously important, and in some cases it certainly is, then shouldn't we be importing it, using it, learning about it, and trying to get our own people able to use it and work with it as much as we can? Why would we shut out that technology at present and then say, okay, we've shut it out, now what? Now we don't use that technology, which is supposed to be so critically important? I think that national security makes a strong argument for importing things and bringing them into the country now as much as we can, so that if the time ever comes when we're cut off, we'll know as much about them and we'll have as much of them as possible. The other real problem with the national security argument is that it gets used for everything, and I mean everything. For example, for many years, mohair was thought of, and officially, was a strategic commodity that we had import restrictions on, because mohair was an ingredient in soldiers' uniforms. And therefore, you know, if we didn't have mohair, our national security would be threatened, our soldiers presumably would have to walk around naked. I mean, it gets silly. The silliest argument, and perhaps the funniest argument I know about the national security argument for protection, comes from the scissors industry. I'd like to read you a statement before Congress in 1962 from a fellow named B.C. Dushley. Mr. Dushley was a president of a scissors company, and this was his argument before Congress for why we really needed to make sure we didn't have imported scissors. He said, "My name is B.C. Dushley. I'm vice president of the Acme Shear Company in Bridgeport, Connecticut. I appear before this committee as president of the Shears, Scissors, and Manicure Implement Manufacturers Association, the only trade association of domestic manufacturers of scissors and shears. The scissors and shears industry is a distinct industry and should not be confused with the larger industry and flatware industries." Then he goes on to say that he wishes they should pass a bill that would shut out imports. He says, "We have never requested or suggested that a complete embargo be placed on the import of scissors and shears. All we ask for and desire is fair competition, not an advantage. The workers in the domestic scissor and shear industry do not want to become wards of the state. They want to use their skills, which have taken years to develop. These workers are not interested in retraining. Over many years, they developed the skill they're proud of and want to continue the work they are happy doing. However, if this bill were to pass," Dushley points out, "this would mean a reduction of at least 20 cents per pair at the retail level for scissors and shears. Manufacturers would be forced to close their doors and discharge their employees. The United States would become wholly dependent on imported scissors and shears. We cannot understand how it would be in the national interest to permit such a loss. We would lose the skills of employees and management of the industry. In the event of a national emergency, with imports cut off, the United States would be without a source of scissors and shears, basic tools for many industries, and trades essential to our national defense. Scissors and shears of all sizes and types are used in every school, retail establishment, office, factory, hospital, and home in the United States. Scissors cannot be classified as a luxury, gimmick, or novelty. Scissors are used to separate us from our mothers at birth, to cut our toenails, to trim the leather in our shoes, to cut and trim the materials used in every piece of clothing that we wear. They're used to cut our fingernails, to trim our mustaches, the hair in our ear and nose, to cut the hair on our heads, even down to the end of the road, when our best suit or dress is cut down the back so the undertaker can dress us for the last ride. Scissors are truly used from birth to death. They are essential to our health, education, and general welfare. I ask you, gentlemen, is this an industry that should be permitted to become extinct in this country?" You start talking national security, and pretty soon you're there with the mohair and the scissors and shears people. You want to be careful before you start using that kind of an argument to justify protectionism. A final argument for protectionism is strategic trade. The idea of strategic trade is that in some industries, and a typical example is the airline industry, there may not be a lot of room for many, many companies to compete in the world. They may be, in the terms we used before, almost a natural monopoly, that really, really large-scale companies will dominate the global economy. The idea there would be that it makes sense to subsidize that sort of a company soon so it can get well-established. Because once you've got the well-established airline company, the company which is doing all the work, then that well-established company will be in a position where it will be able to fight off all challengers from then on. So that, again, is an argument for a short-term subsidy, because in the short term we'll build up a competitor, and that competitor in the long run will be able to keep competing. Now, there's an argument here for subsidizing the firm, and it's an argument which, in certain contexts and certain theoretical models, can make sense. But I guess the problem I keep coming back to with protectionism is, and it really works well as an argument in this case, okay, let's say there's an argument that you want to subsidize the industry. Let's say a subsidy makes sense. Let's say we want to go out and subsidize the industry. Fine. Why can't we do it directly? Why can't we do it above board? Why do we have to do it through this weird way of shutting out competition and making consumers pay more? After all, if you think about it, if we want to subsidize some firm, why is it that having the consumer pay a higher price is the right way to subsidize it? Why shouldn't we have a debate before Congress where Congress says, hey, we think it's important to spend hard-earned tax money subsidizing this industry, and we're going to give them a tax break, or we're going to give them a grant of some kind, and we're going to go ahead and subsidize that firm. This idea that somehow it makes sense to subsidize the firm indirectly has all the problems we talked about with controlling and affecting prices before. It makes the prices work not quite so well. And so if we want to subsidize, and I'm not a big fan of government subsidies, as you've probably guessed, but if you want to subsidize, let's at least do it openly and above board. Let's not do it by removing competitive pressures and shutting out competition from abroad. When you think about trade, though, and you think about this issue of protectionism, you have to say to yourself, well, why should the political system get this right? Because when we start talking about the explicit costs of explicit subsidies, you begin to notice why protectionism makes sense. Protectionism looks so easy. You can sort of say, well, it's just a matter of fairness. It's just a matter of fairness. And there's a group out there, a particular industry, which really is benefiting, which really is getting concentrated benefits from this action. Meanwhile, the higher costs are being paid by a lot of consumers spread around out there. They're each paying a little bit more, but the truth is they probably don't even really know the difference. They probably don't even really know that the price of the car they're buying is a few hundred dollars higher because imports from Japan were shut out. There's no unbudget cost. You don't have to vote for higher taxes. You don't have to vote for higher spending. You just vote for fairness and then use the rules in order to direct that indirect subsidy. When you do economic studies of these things and you say, how much do people pay through higher prices as a result of protectionism, and how many jobs get saved in particular industries as a result of protectionism, what you tend to find is very large numbers, that people are paying overall $100,000, $200,000, even $300,000 in higher prices to save every individual job out there in whatever industry is being affected. Among other things, it would just be cheaper to collect tax money from people and save jobs directly if that's what we want to try and do. This helps explain, at least to me, why governments sign treaties about foreign trade. One way of thinking about treaties about foreign trade is that they're a way of holding off these domestic special interest groups. You say, okay, I'm going to get together with all these other countries. We're going to sign the General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs, which has now evolved into the World Trade Organization. We're going to sign this treaty with the WTO, or we're going to sign NAFTA. Why do we do that? Well, partly we think there are gains from free trade, but also signing a treaty provides us with some kind of insulation. The next time the scissors and shears people or somebody else come up to us and says, you know, we must save this industry, we must save this industry, you have to give us this indirect subsidy, we can say, well, we sure would like to help you out there. However, we signed a treaty. And we signed a treaty and we can't. So in a way, all these treaties about free trade can be thought of as a way for government to tie its own hands. To tie its own hands and say, we're just not going to do that, and we're going to tie our hands in a way where politically it will be very difficult for special interests to lobby for this kind of subsidy. When I think about trade, I think about a couple of different things, I guess. One in particular is thinking about an image of trade and the argument for free trade in a way that perhaps will shift your thinking a little bit. Let me sort of ask a series of questions and try and get a series of answers back from you. There's been a lot of new technology development in the 20th century, and most of us, as we talked about in the chapter on growth, think that on balance, most of this technology has been, by and large, a good thing for the standard of living. Imagine someone were to say to you, in the technology context, there's a new company out there. This new company has a great new technology. However, this new technology is so good that it's going to put some other companies out of work, and those other companies are going to have to lay off their people. Should we shut out this new technology and save the jobs, or should we allow the new technology to happen, knowing that those jobs will be wiped out? Which do we choose? Well, I think that most people in the 20th century say, well, this is one of these hard things about markets, and it's one of these hard things about development. But ultimately, I believe we should help unemployed people. Maybe we should help with unemployment and retraining and welfare and all kinds of things. But you can't just stop the clock on technology. You can't say, we're just going to cut off this new technology. We're not going to let any new technology happen. If we had that kind of law in the United States, you know, we'd still be riding around on horses and looking at things through gas lights and candles. You have to let the new technology happen, even if you try and cushion the blow in all the ways that someone might want to try and do that. Now, follow-up question. If you accept the logic up until this point, at least in broad terms, now you find out that the new company, the new technology that they're using is, they're importing it from abroad. It's not a new piece of machinery, in other words, that they're using. It's just that they're bringing it in from abroad. Now, how do you feel about this new technology, this new process, where trade is thought of in a way as a kind of new technology? It's bringing it in from another place. Well, I would suggest that exactly the same set of arguments applies. Exactly the same set of arguments. The idea that we should shut off technology because it will dislocate some jobs and cause a readjustment process is exactly the same argument as let's shut out trade to try and save some jobs and prevent the need for a readjustment process. In exactly the same way, if we can produce something more efficiently, if we can produce something in a cheaper and better and more productive way, we should take advantage of those opportunities, whether they come through technology or whether they come through trade. Because over time, taking advantage of those opportunities is what raises productivity, what raises our long-term standard of living. And if we start shutting off those possibilities, then we're going to be eventually, not immediately, but eventually, lagging behind and in deep trouble in terms of our overall standard of living. So I think of trade just as another market force, not one that needs special treatment or special concern. There are a lot of stresses in the U.S. economy. There are sometimes bad managers. There's new products. There are fads. There's new technologies. There are workers where things go bad because of weather or lack of training. Many things are happening all the time that push people around, throw people out of work, cause problems. And while I believe that we should try and cushion those blows, I also believe that it's important for us to accept them. And to accept them and flow with them and take advantage of the gains to productivity which result. Let me give the last word to this thinking about trade to Frederick Bastiat. You may remember Bastiat's name from Lecture 1. He was the one who talked about markets as a way of feeding Paris. In another one of his essays, he talks about free trade and the balance of free trade. And he uses a metaphor of two towns, which he calls Stulta and Puera, which I think are short for stultified and puerile. This is what Bastiat writes about free trade. There were, no matter where, two towns called Stulta and Puera. They completed at great cost a highway from one town to the other. When this was done, Stulta said to herself, "See how Puera inundates us with her products. We must see to it." In consequence, they created and paid a body of obstructives, so called because their business was to place obstacles in the way of traffic coming from Puera. Soon afterwards, Puera did the same. At the end of some centuries, knowledge in the interim having made great progress, the common sense of Puera enabled her to see that such reciprocal obstacles could only be reciprocally hurtful. She therefore sent a diplomatist to Stulta, who, laying aside the official phraseology, spoke to this effect. "We have made a highway, and now we throw obstacles in the way of using it. This is absurd. It would have been better to have left things as they were. We should not, in that case, have had to pay for making the road in the first place, nor afterwards have incurred the expense of maintaining the obstructives. In the name of Puera, I come to propose to you not to give up opposing each other all at once. That would be to act on principle, and we despise principle as much as you do, but to lessen somewhat the present obstacles, taking care to estimate equitably the respective sacrifices we make for this purpose. So spoke the diplomatist. Stulta asked for time to consider the proposal and proceeded to consult, in succession, her manufacturers and agriculturalists. At length, after the lapse of years, she declared negotiations were broken off. On receiving this intimation, the inhabitants of Puera held a meeting. An old gentleman, and they had always suspected he had been secretly bought by Stulta, rose and said, "The obstacles created by Stulta injure our sales, which is a misfortune. Those which we have created ourselves injure our purchases, which is another misfortune. With reference to the first, that is, the obstacles created by the other country, we are powerless. But the second set of obstacles rests with ourselves. Let us at least get rid of one, since we cannot get rid of both evils. Let us get rid of our own obstructives without requiring Stulta to do the same. Some day, no doubt, she will come to know her own interests better." A second counselor, a practical, matter-of-fact man, guiltless of any acquaintance with principles and brought up in the ways of his forefathers, replied, "Don't listen to that utopian dreamer, that theorist, that innovator, that economist, that stultomaniac. We will all be undone if the stoppages of the road are not equalized, weighted, and balanced between Stulta and Puera. There would be a greater difficulty in going than in coming, in exporting than in importing." This reasoning, so conclusive, convinced the assembly, and the orator followed up his victory by talking about national independence, national honor, national dignity, national labor, inundation of products, tributes, and murderous competition. In short, he carried the vote in favor of the maintenance of the obstacles. And if you are at all curious on the subject, I can point out to you countries where you will see with your own eyes road makers and obstructives working together on the most friendly terms possible, under the orders of the same legislative assembly, at the expense of the same taxpayers, one endeavoring to clear the road and the other set doing their utmost to render it impassable. Think about it for a moment. All over the world, private companies and governments are spending enormous amounts of time and energy to come together and make market-oriented transactions. They're spending enormous time and energy to do that. And at the same time, simultaneously, they're lobbying to their governments to put obstacles in the way of all this trade, which they're spending billions and billions of dollars to make work in the first place. This is crazy. I would say that the right approach to free trade is for the U.S. to practice free trade, at least get rid of our own obstacles. Other countries in time will come to know their interests better, but we do not benefit from raising our own costs to our own trade.